I'm Gene Kansas. You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. We cover the arts, architecture, design, development, city planning, preservation. Today's show, the art of education.
Self-taught is a weird expression, and it really isn't very valid when we talk about self-taught African-American artists that are my focus now for 25 years or more. They're not really self-taught, and that's a whole thing that when you said, let's come talk about education, I thought that's what we really do need to talk about, is how do you define education for artists?
We would put forth, our thesis that we put forth, is that the dining hall is as powerful of a learning experience or place as the lecture hall is. And in fact, we would put forth that there is more meaningful life education happens in the dining hall or outside the building or between the formal learning environments than it does really in the formal learning environment. Sure, your technical knowledge comes in those formal learning environments, but your coping skills, your interactive skills, your communication skills are honed and your awareness of diversity and these other things happens so much more or can happen so much more in a really well-designed student life space.
My guests today are art collector and explorer Bill Arnett, the founder and chief curator of Tinwood Media.
I've been all over the world looking at art, historical environments and architectural groups, and here in Birmingham, Alabama, in the woods on a hill, was what I thought was as remarkable as anything I'd ever seen.
Architect and student life expert Jeff Stebar.
We fundamentally believe that education not only has the power to solve the issues that we face today as a society, but that architecture can frame that education, and I don't mean just a building, I mean the built environment, can frame an educational experience that can be transformative. And that isn't limited to just the four walls around the accounting building.
And Atlanta arts critic, Kathy Fox.
I think a person who has his or her antennae up is going to be affected and influenced by where they are, whether they want to be or not. Bringing in new ideas, the clash of culture, these are things that are part of urban life, and urban life, as we know, is the petri dish for creativity.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, The Art of Education. We will begin our discussion with someone who began his career in the arts without any formal knowledge.
Self-taught? No, I didn't make up art history.
Which is to say, he began much in the same way as any of us might begin, guided simply by curiosity.
Well, I wasn't an art major at all. In fact, I took in my entire educational career, I took one course in art appreciation, which I don't remember anything about.
Where were you?
I was at the University of Georgia when I became an English major. I went to Wharton School at University of Pennsylvania, but that wasn't a career path for me. I mean, I thought at some point in my life everybody has to have a career and go into business and do something. And since I didn't want to be a lawyer and I didn't want to be a doctor, I didn't know what. So I ended up moving to Europe at a young age after I graduated, and realizing that that's what I wanted to do the rest of my life was learn about art, study it, and pursue it. And to that extent, I traveled all over the world and ended up over a period of time. By the time I was 30, I'd been to 60 countries, I guess, at least, looking at art and learning, collecting some and writing about it. And I, to my credit, and I'll boast a little bit from time to time, I learned a hell of a lot and became, by I guess the time I was in my late 20s, I mean, I was something of a recognized expert throughout the world in certain subjects and was consulted by museums and on authenticity and provenance. Well, I mean, I wasn't a specialist, and I'm glad I wasn't. It wasn't until much later that I realized there was something worth specializing in.
What is perhaps most interesting about Bill Arnett's story is that his artistic self-discovery eventually culminated in one of the great arts discoveries of the last 50 years.
I had, after having traveled the world for decades, I came back to live in the South where I'm from. I'm from Georgia. And the one thing that I had learned convincingly is that great art is always accompanied by great architecture, great music, great literature, written or oral. a whole cultural spectrum is what develops in every mature civilization. Well, the Southern Black civilization, if you could call it one, it wasn't officially one because it was theoretically American, but America didn't treat it like it. And it had produced the greatest music. And by that point in time, I wasn't the only one. I mean, I kind of thought that in the 50s, but by the 60s or so, when the music industry started changing, but at least a lot of the things of my youth were becoming recognized as important, it was obvious that the black music of the South, and this is not black musicians who went to Juilliard, these are rural for the most part or urban, but black musicians who were not trained, who were not officially trained. But does that mean they didn't have training? They all were surrounded by other great musicians, and this is how music was taught. And what I'm saying is that the visual arts have been taught the world over for the last 10,000 years. Art's been taught by people who create it and are surrounded by other people who want to learn to create it, and they look at those who are superior and try to emulate them and occasionally become superior to those who they learn from.
The art of the Southern Black slave tradition is magnificent in its technical accomplishment and staggering creativity, but it also poses some very difficult questions about the nature and nurturing of arts education. None of these artists had any formal arts education or any education at all, really. Their work wasn't encouraged through patronage or hung on the walls for mass consumption. We often describe and understand this work as quote unquote folk art, but as Bill Arnett is quick to point out,
I don't have any idea what African-American folk art actually is, and I don't have any interest in folk art. And the term folk art is demeaning and pejorative and is used as a way to keep some of the most important and thrilling and cerebral artists in history out with the lame excuse that, well, they're folk artists and we focus here in high art. And I use the word high advisedly.
What would the right way to describe it be?
Well, there's no accepted term for what I'm interested in. It's traditional art that comes out of the African-American community. Specifically, what I'm talking about is a body of art which evolved out of slavery and stayed hidden until the Civil Rights Movement, which made it, which justified black people coming out in the open and doing things they had done in secret for centuries. It was a surprise to find out not that it was there, but how much of it and how great it was. And I became something of a fanatic at that point, like, say, a scuba diver that finds Atlantis and just wants people to know it. And I started documenting it, researching it, and devoted the rest of my life, and have devoted the rest of my life to it. My children, I have four sons, and each of them, as they finished their education, came in and were similarly inclined to want to do this. Once you get bitten and realize that there is some great national treasure out there that has been completely unrecognized, then there's an inclination to want people to know about it, and that's what we do. And we just continued. That was almost 25 years ago. And subsequently, I found or interviewed or photographed hundreds and hundreds of such people, some of whom make things that can be commodified and hung on walls, but that's not basically what this art is about. And some don't. Some do things in the deep woods that are never intended to be seen and create things that if you took them out of context and put them on a museum wall, they wouldn't look lost. They'd look like precious objects that should have been on museum walls already. And that's been what our books and what our work has been about, has been finding these artists, understanding what these cultural accomplishments actually mean in the context of a culture which is unique in the history of the world. That is, a slave population that was deprived the right to anything, to names, to clothing, to philosophies, ideals, religions, and yet developed on their own without any help some of the greatest cultural attributes in the world, not just music, but visual arts, textiles, dance, language. It's a great culture that's just been officially looked down upon in this country and in the world.
That was Bill Arnett, founder of Tim Wood Media. You can also hear Bill talk in greater depth about some of the artists he's worked with, including the G's Bend Quilters and Lonnie Holly, in an interview by AM1690's own David Lewis. We'll have a link up on the Sidewalk Radio blog at sidewalkradio.com. Let us now turn to the more formal setting of education, the classroom, which is currently in the process of a design revolution. Paint the landscape, if you will, of where the design for higher education is now, and then where is it going through that?
You know, higher education has been around for 1,200 years or more, you know, since Oxford was established. And Oxford's coming up on their millennial anniversary here in a few years. And so there's been people doing this for a long, long time. And for the vast majority of that time, it's been very much a hierarchical-based teaching method where there's an instructor standing in front of a bunch of students who didn't work with the instructor, but they were treated as empty vessels or sponges, and the professor pontificated and dispensed his knowledge on the group. That has changed so dramatically and is continuing to change and will change to, it's hard to believe where these things are going to end up. We're in a transitional period right now. You know, there's so many factors. One of the factors we talk about that affected higher education so powerfully is technology. And what technology has done is, for the first time in this 1,200-year history of higher education, it has separated knowledge from the institution. Traditionally, if we wanted to have a Harvard education or learn what Harvard University professors knew, we had to attend Harvard University. And that could be the same for any university anywhere in the country or in the world. Now, with technology giving genuine universal access to information, it has completely separated that ownership of the knowledge. So I can now access online Harvard education, and I can access online learning from anywhere in the world. So it makes this the question of what is a campus much foggier.
Of course, and I would assume you agree that the campus experience, there's a whole set of learning there that goes on beyond the classroom.
And that is so critical, because that's exactly what student life is about. It's about the out-of-classroom experience. There's so much learning that happens beyond the formal learning environments of a university. And what we're seeing, and in fact, if I had to sit here and just tell you where I think student life is going, our thesis is that in the higher education environment of tomorrow, what you're going to see is more learning outside of the classroom, not less, more of that. The key here is you're going to see institutions start to try to formalize the outcomes of that out-of-classroom experience. So it won't just be, you know, where does Junior want to go get a cheeseburger for lunch today? And he happens to run into a person, and then they have this interaction, and that creates some type of learning experience. It's going to be more about taking the formal educational goals of the institution and then shaping the student life experience to help enable or help actualize that out-of-classroom learning experience. Can I give you an example?
Yeah, please.
At Colorado State University, where we're working currently, one of the student centers we're doing, one of their academic goals for the institution is to provide a truly diverse cultural and ethnic experience for the students that come to Colorado State. Colorado is not known as a terribly diverse area, but they want to create this and make this experience with diversity something their students are so well versed in, because that's where the future of demographics show this country will be in other countries. It's going to be much more about racial, cultural, and ethnic diversity. And so in order to do that, as we looked at designing a student center for them, there were multiple programs in this student center that dealt with different advocacy groups, Asian American associations, Native Americans, Black students, Hispanic students. And so all these different groups had advocacy areas that supported them and assisted them in their university experience. what we've done in the layout of this new student union is we've grouped all those together and created a center for this type of advocacy, and then placed this in an incredibly prominent area right at the main entrance of the building, so people will walk through this thing.
What does that look like?
Walk around. What does what look like?
What is like a grouping from a design architectural perspective look like?
In a physical space, if you can picture for yourself a small town where you have individual houses that have a front porch on them, and then the front porches face a park. Okay, let's use that as a model. Now internalize that into a building where you have each of these advocacy areas having their own identity along a student lounge that becomes the park, where they each have a front porch or an identity along this thing. And then as you cross this kind of public area of the porch, you enter their cultural home, and you enter more of the private space that's more supportive of each ethnic group. That whole idea of physical space and the relationship you have person to person and person to place is something we study at great lengths. What does it mean to experience a building? How do you experience, how does a student experience a building as opposed to an administrator? One of the things that today that's a challenge for students is most universities are organized around their departmental silos. They're not organized around the student experience. Now don't make me say it twice. You can put away your lessons, throw away your book, 'cause I'm gonna tell you what cooks. Venus was a woman who had a lot of charm, but she got so much hug and she wore out both her arms. But you don't learn that in school. You don't learn that in school. There ain't no doubt about it. You don't learn that in school. Napoleon was a soldier, the smartest ever seen, but he learned his maneuvers alone with Josephine. But you don't learn that in school. You don't learn that in school. There ain't no doubt about it. You don't learn that in school.
Are the arts being contemplated in the schools that you see?
You know, that varies wildly, or maybe I should say varies widely when we look at different institutions. We just completed a new student center at Texas A&M University. And Texas A&M has a military tradition. It was an all-male school to the 70s when it became co-ed. And they have integrated art galleries into the student union, formal gallery space, because they didn't have any other arts programs on campus, and that's how they wanted to introduce that to their student. Other places we work, we've been working with the University of Kentucky for several years to define their new university center, what it needs to be. The director there has been the student union director for 30-some-odd years. He's seen a huge transition from the 70s till now. And he said back in the day, as he refers to it, it was very easy to select an act, a national act, to come into the university and put them in this big ballroom space and get 5,000 people to show up to watch. There was a more universal ability to select one group and have everybody come to it. He said, now, he said, I rarely need a venue where I have 5,000 people. He said, because everybody is so into their own genres of, and these micro genres of what they're looking for. He said, what I need now is I need 5 venues that seat 500. I don't need one that seats 5,000. And I think to maybe sum up all of this, what we see is this future of student life, specifically on campus, is formalizing what we call the space between. And it's the space between all the formal learning environments. It's taking these areas where people interact and where they used to just be left to serendipity, and intentionalizing that serendipity, if I can say that. It's
inspiring
it. Yeah, framing it so you encourage certain outcomes. Like I mentioned with Colorado State and their diversity programs, at Texas A&M we did a study for them that they were trying to encourage student and faculty interaction. That's something that's very hard to do when you think about in a lecture hall. It's a very challenging thing. And co-location does not equal collaboration. That's something that's a myth. That some people think, well, if you just co-locate everybody, put them all next to each other, they'll collaborate. Not so, okay? What we did at A&M in this study that we did for them, we brought certain faculty offices into the student union. we put in a certain number of offices. It could be signed out by the faculty, so maybe some of their office hours each week are done in the student center. We located it, surrounded those around a small student lounge area that had whiteboards and technology and flat screen monitors, and then put that next to the coffee shop so that this place became a place people wanted to hang out. The faculty wanted to be there, and then also the students would be able to sit there in a completely non-formal, non-threatening environment, interact with their instructor, and literally pull their laptop out and broadcast it up on a screen. You learn how to use the environment and the differences in environment and the advantages and disadvantages to each type of those environments to frame the activity you're in and make it more effective.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, The Art of Education, brought to you by Perkins & Will. For most of us, returning to the classroom or journeying out into the great unknown like Bill Arnett, well, those aren't really practical options. Instead of professors, our casual education on the arts is dependent on curators and critics who expose us to art in our everyday lives and help us access its meaning through example and explanation. As our final guest today, we have Kathy Fox, a long-writing critic and reporter of Atlanta.
There are many more people who can draw a figure or can handle paint or make a print than there are artists who have good ideas. And good ideas don't come out of thin air. And that is why I'm a proponent of lifelong learning and a proponent of a liberal arts education. You don't always know what interests you until you discover it. And a liberal arts education, kind of the way a newspaper used to be, was an opportunity to follow paths that you wouldn't otherwise find yourself on, to discover new things to be interested in, and to broaden your knowledge in areas that you never know how they're going to come back to you and serve you. And we think our website and sites like Burnaway help filter information. One of the problems is there's just too much. The abundance is daunting, and I don't know, a lot of people would just shut down. There's just too much to see, too much to know about, too much going on. Throw up your hands. But we like to think of ourselves as filters, selecting things that we think are of interest, and then you're free to agree or not, but at least to narrow the pool a little bit. When I was working at the paper, I understood that I was not writing just for my peers and for those in the field, that the point was, and the higher calling really, was to try to reach people who weren't already in the circle. And I had this ideal audience, which was friends I know who live down the street who are not arts professionals but who are interested in the arts and are curious people, and I would imagine myself writing to them. And I felt like I had to make it entertaining.
Why do you do this?
Why do I do what? Write about art?
Mm-hmm.
Put out a publication?
Yeah.
I love it. It's a way of thinking for me. It's a way of perceiving the world. I've found it endlessly intellectually stimulating. I've met fabulous people. I've had amazing experiences. It's really been the ticket to a really rewarding life for me. It feels good to do it.
That was Kathy Fox, a longtime Atlanta arts critic and reporter. You can read her expansive coverage at artsatl.com. And speaking of art criticism, we had a little art show of our own last week. It was called the Sidewalk Art Project, and it was in the spirit of education both for Atlanta and the arts. Sidewalk Radio teamed up with SCAD Atlanta in this creative partnership that took previously aired episodes and made them a part of the curriculum of the School of Fine Arts. The students listened to the shows, and from that experience created amazing original works of art from them. On June 21st, we held the show at the Atlanta Preservation Center. Two students were selected best in show, and our congratulations go out to Elizabeth Castaldo and Nate Camp. I want to thank our judging panel for the Sidewalk Art Project, who included Spalding Nix, Bruce McAvoy, Ronnie Land, and Stuart Herodner. If you'd like to see the work of Elizabeth and Nate, please visit us on Facebook at facebook.com/sidewalkradio. I want to thank my guests today, Bill Arnett, Jeff Stebar, and Kathy Fox. Of course, I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Perkins & Will, ideas and buildings that honor the broader goals of society. This is Gene Kansas, host of Sidewalk Radio. We'll see you next month.